Live from the In the Bin podcast, Debate Research Studios, here in lovely, livable Jamaica, Queens, New York, this is In the Bin. Possibly the number one or two podcast still on debate and issues related to rhetoric and all that. I'm Dr. Steve Yano, professor of Rhetoric and Communication Studies Department at St. John's. Good to have you with us. If you like the show, you can get all the show notes at notd.io/s/inthebinpodcast or email us at inthebinpodcast@gmail.com. And it's been a little bit of time, but I thought I would revitalize the podcast. What better people to do it with than Dr. Tim Barr? He's been on the show before. You've been on the show a few times, yeah?
Yeah.
As his spleen doctor allows. We're trying to avoid the seventh artificial spleen surgery. Or maybe it's eighth by now. I don't know.
I just want it taken out. I don't want another one.
Yeah, but have to have another one.
Yeah.
Isn't that new federal law? New federal spleen legislation?
Legisplension.
And also we have, I'm gonna mispronounce it again, Misha.
That's right. You got it.
And Misha comes to us from the live world of debate. I'm no longer in debate. I say that, but it's kind of like Michael Corleone kind of stuff. I keep getting emails and pulled back in here and there. People still reach out to me for debate stuff, but I do write a lot and try to get a lot of scholarly stuff done about debate. But the podcast, I think, is probably the best thing that I ever did with that. With that stuff. Misha's currently a student, former SGU debater in 2007, coached high school LD for a time, went away for several years, and has done a year of college forensics and is feeling jaded all over again. Wow.
Yeah.
Double jade experience.
Yeah. That feels like at the end of 4 years of high school forensics, just in 1 year.
Wow. Now that's efficiency.
Yeah, we really, really,
If only the NDSA could bottle that.
I'm sure they would.
The eligibility.
I'm not sure they would want to.
No, they probably would. Well, I don't know. They could charge, well, like 4 years, you only get to charge one membership fee per school. They could do double charge. They'd be like, well, you're having 2 years in one. You'd be a quadruple diamond coach or whatever they do. I don't even know if they do that anymore. NDSA, I'm out of touch with them too, but they are, they created this new format called Big Questions. I don't know very much about it, but it appears on Reddit from time to time. Probably should look into it. But
across it.
Yeah, you did.
I did, but I can't tell you anything about it. I'm still trying to figure out what it is. It was confusing to me.
I think it's self-referential. It itself is the big question.
Yeah. I'm not a double diamond coach. I'm just a bunny slope coach. So I don't know these big questions.
Oh my God. Okay. So I first got involved in the National Forensics League like in the 90s. And this is the first time I have made the connection between diamond and double diamond and skiing.
I don't even know what you're talking about. So that's the only reference I had.
So they have,
what is this double diamond?
Very much like professional sports. They have rankings for coaches based on how many points your students earn. And so students earn points for how they participate in events at the NFL level. Now, they don't count everything. So, for example, I was a high school coach in Texas many, many years ago at a little lovely little high school called A&M Consolidated High School. It has a very functional name, like store brand pasta or something.
Is that in College Station?
It's in College Station. That's correct. And I joined it then when I started doing it. I was like, what is this bullshit? And then I got a degree, like this little formal degree as a member. And then I got stickers showing my coaching rank and people who are doing well, like they're a three diamond coach. And there's like, these are like the Hall of Famers or whatever. Well, they're eligible for the Hall of Fame, but they don't all make it into the Hall of Fame. It's kind of ridiculous.
So the coaches are competing too. I never heard of that before.
Of course
the coaches are competing. Yeah,
the coaches are down there in Houston. Those people were some of the worst human beings I ever met in my life. But That's a whole other episode. We can go down the list if we want to, but okay. My God. But you know, university has these kind of like slimy characters, but high school debate is full of them.
Pretty bad.
Yeah, you were coaching LD in Texas, right?
Yeah. I lived in Austin for 15 years. And also since, you know, when I was in high school, I was in Oklahoma. Texas was easily the closest debate hub.
You go to Dallas.
I know a lot of the Texas scumbags.
Yeah. Did you go to Dallas a lot for tournaments?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Green Hills, St. Mark's were, you know.
Oh, man. Aaron Timmons. Aaron Timmons is still around.
Absolutely.
Yeah, he's doing the World Schools team. So he's involved in international debate at the World Schools, which is like the high school 3-on-3. Every country has a team kind of competition, but I think he pulls from the NSDA national pool. So you got like 5,000 people you can pick from to get your team of five. It's a little crazy.
Wow. That's a lot of applications to look through.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, he's, when I coached against Timmons, he had his finger on the pulse of everything and knew things long before anybody else did. I remember it won a state tournament. I was waiting for the breaks to see how my policy teams did. And he just walked through the room and looked at me. He's like, clearing three at your first state. That's excellent. And then just left. And then like 50 minutes later, out came the break list and I'd cleared three teams. So
that sounds about right. I definitely have memories of Timmons being super duper connected and also, yeah, just aware of everything that was going on.
Yeah.
Debated him in front of him at the TOC my senior year.
Oof.
We won. It felt good because I did very, very, very poorly at the Green Hill tournament that year. I think it was like 1-5 or something like that.
Yeah, it happens sometimes to where a tournament like St. Mark's or Green Hill will actually be harder to get to semis than the TOC. This is rare, but it does kind of sometimes occur depending on what it draws. I mean, I'm talking years ago. I don't know what the pandemic has done to all of this stuff. I imagine it's a lot less competitors now.
I have to imagine so. I definitely, my experience, you know, debating this year was, and also just being on the team for speech stuff, was that it definitely overall tournaments seemed much less populated than what I am used to. There were a decent number of virtual events that we did over the year, one of which was fairly large, though otherwise, I mean, by far, like the virtual debate only stuff that I did was much more populated than any of the other stuff we did this year, which was a little surprising to see, especially, I don't know, we're in, you know, in Illinois, you know, we're in the same area as, you know, Northwestern and what have you, right? Definitely expect to see.
Yeah,
based on the old experience, lots and lots of people met at these things, but
I would imagine Northwestern is a program where the speech people and the debate people never interact.
Seems quite possible.
Yeah, I would think that's because they're like all in on NDT. It's my understanding, but I mean things have changed a lot. I mean the pandemic's impact on debate, we don't really know because no one's really talking about it. I know the virtual events. You look at those; it's a little embarrassing. What happened with the virtual events? You have a Discord tournament, and it's like a cosplay of a weekend tournament. Like, why are we having octos at 8 in the morning when we have the internet? Like, I mean, why aren't we spreading this shit out over several. I mean, people aren't doing anything. It's lockdown. Why are we not innovating the format? We still have a live format where it starts at 8:30 and the judges sit there and flow and like, what the hell? Like, just, I mean, there's so many cooler things you could have been doing. The pandemic was like a lost opportunity for the debate world in toto because nobody messed with the format. They just wanted to have their same tired old horrific weekend slogs, but just on digital format.
Yeah. Let me tell you is, you know, save all the, you know, discussion for tournament sucking in general aside, like all of this.
Sort no, if we know, put that aside, we won't, if we put that aside, we won't have a show.
Well, I just meant for just this brief sentence here, right?
Yeah, right.
That, like, you know, it's when it's all virtual, you know, the sort of the reward cycle is really, really thrown off.
Yeah,
it's a lot more slog and a lot less fun. Way fewer highs. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, what's the biggest? You've been, how long were you away between being involved with debate at all and then returning to debate? What, how long of a time was that for you?
About probably 7 years.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty significant. So, what's the biggest change now that you're a competitor again? What's blowing your mind? What are you doing? You're doing NPDA, I assume, or you're doing a number of different things.
So, for a good portion of the year, I did NFALD, and did IPDA for most of the latter half of the year.
IPDA is the among people I know, IPDA is the new savior. Like how BP was going. BP was.
I don't really
save.
Know much about it. Would it be okay to have like a primer on what IPDA is a little
sure.
bit? Sure. I don't know much about it.
I think that would be good.
IPDA, so a half hour before the round starts, you and your opponent are presented a list of 5 topics, and you go back and forth, starting with the negative, you go back and forth, striking from the topics. And the one that is left over, you have a half hour to prep, you know, but you know, for whichever side you're on, then like it's intended to be relatively lay focused and you can't like read anything, right? I mean, like you can read your handwritten notes, but like you can't.
Can't access it materials.
Can be quoting evidence, right? You can cite stuff to be sure, but you can't. Right? You can't. There's the idea is no transcribed, no written evidence. And so it's like Lincoln Douglas structure, like about minus a minute, and there's no prep time between speeches and rounds. So 5 minute affirmative constructive, 2 minute. Cross-ex, 6 minute first negative, 2 minute cross-ex, 3 minute first affirmative rebuttal, 5 minute negative rebuttal, 3 minute affirmative summary.
Okay.
And you'll get, you know, questions of value, questions of policy, some, you know, silly metaphors sometimes. I debated at the state tournament this year. Our finals topic was "It is immoral to be rich." What are some other things we debated throughout that tournament? Is it moral to visit Antarctica?
every debate is about whether something is moral or not.
I love.
That does sound like LB.
Oh my god, I love that topic.
In high school, I definitely will metagame towards to sort of value-based topics because it's my wheelhouse, right?
It's funny that, like, you know, I've been looking through debate textbooks trying to kind of prepare myself, being like, what's going on? You know, I just haven't really been thinking in these forms. I've been teaching debate, but I've been teaching it in public speaking. And so like pretty about as lacking kind of format as you can have it, just like a couple speeches, some questions and stuff like that. So I was looking at John Meany's book on parliamentary debate. And in the introduction, he talks about Lincoln Douglas. He's like, we don't deal with technical things like policy debate or Lincoln Douglas, except as a side thing. And I'm like, I didn't realize that that became like a technical debate format. But I guess that's kind of the way it all goes. Because I thought Lincoln Douglas was pretty. I mean, people have like value propositions. I remember judging a few of them, but I guess that became more technical too. That format of debate.
It certainly did. It had a whole thing over the last like 25 years. It was what I debated in high school. And I debated, you know, at the national level, did the TOC and all that stuff. And while the topics were still primarily very value driven, like people were absolutely like spreading, you know, they're absolutely, you know, people running, you know, yeah, critiques of 300 words per minute and weird theory and T and stuff. And because like all of this was relatively new, like there was definitely some seven off no alternative stuff for a while, right?
I taught a bunch of NFA LD people at the University of Vermont summer camp years ago, and they were great. They were from Kentucky, but when we would do a practice debate, I'm like, I don't know how to evaluate this. But then it just became cardless. It was just at that time, this would have been the early 2000s, it was cardless policy debate. So you really could do seven off, and they could be dissads, and you would just assert the link and the uniqueness.
Okay.
And the impact, maybe you'd have a card for the impact, but like, you know, several levels of asserted link debate is not something I'd wish on anybody. It was a little wild. And then, but what was interesting is I feel like when I saw that, I felt, well, Texas high school LD, which kind of is the barometer for TOC LD, I would say, that felt in the early 90s when I was in high school watching it to the late 90s when I was a high school coach coaching it, changed a lot. But it was a real, it took a long time to get to the point where you're like, you know, I'm critiquing the resolution. So you just had resolutional link criticisms where the value would be something like nihilism. We can't have words with meanings, so we must reject the motion. Like it was this kind of like, almost like the way critiques were in policy debate at first, where it's like, oh, you use money, capitalism critique. Alternative, don't do the plan. Like these very basic early kind of, I mean, it's come a long way since then, but it's that initial change takes a long time and is very, very insufficient. And then like the responses to critiques would be like just so easy. Like, we only have a 7-minute speech. We don't have time to discuss nihilism. Sorry. This is in a wrong forum. This is the wrong forum for a philosophical discussion. Yeah. Oh, but it's the right forum to talk about U.S. foreign policy to Saudi Arabia. That's fine in 8 minutes. That's totally fine in 8 minutes, but we can't talk about capitalism in 8 minutes. Oh, you lose. And but that's literally what was happening.
Yeah.
That's a long time ago.
And the flip side of that too was right, was just sort of like, definitely, you know, when people would, you know, just run the 15-second each, you know, nihilism a priori, and somebody was just, you know, make a theory argument, and they'd just be like, oh, you, what's fairness? Nobody cares. And everybody was like, yeah, that's good enough.
Yeah, I do think there's a kind of a poetic element to nihilism blips on the solvency flow that seems appropriate to me.
Right.
That's pretty funny.
Texas, as someone who, did it through, I guess, up through like the mid early 10s, the Green Hill definitely is a good, you know, a good barometer for like overall national circuit LD. Texas had a bit of a reputation in the rest of the LD world for not. for being a little more gamesmanshipy than a lot of the rest of the LD world.
Those Green Hill semis and finals were always really hard to evaluate. Even in the audience, you watch those, you'd be like, "Woof, pretty techy." I think you could write, like what Tim was saying, I bet you could write a book called From Techne to Technology, American High School Debate. That would be like, that could be a good book. But I'm very frustrated in my research projects right now because people take debate so flippant. It's so important, but it's so flippant. Or maybe it's embarrassing. There's not a record left of these debates. No one keeps any records. There's nothing in the archives, nothing. It's hard to find anything to really sink your intellectual teeth into if you wanted to make arguments about debate changing historically. But, I mean, most debate coaches are not intellectuals. They're like sports coaches. They're interested in the game in front of them. They might talk about a legendary coach. Oh, yeah, that guy was so impressive. He was an amazing judge. Wonder what ever happened to him. But there's not any desire or any sense to keep a record of these things to watch how they changed over time. And when you do try to do that, when you try to record them, people get angry at you. They're like, I don't want a recording of that.
That's the thing I think that would need to be changed the most. And maybe the sports metaphor is the right one to kind of sneak in some archival desire. Because, of course, you know, people are like endlessly celebrate old sports teams by going back through statistics, but also basically the televisual moments of sports are when people's sports memories begin. So being able to like watching tape as part of practice in athletics, maybe that's the way to convince people that this is good. And then you kind of build up an archive in that way of what they have. But I plan to like archive all of the debates. I mean, that was part of what I asked for was like, I need like everything, every practice and every debate that we do should be recorded and put on the channel, both for our purposes, but so that people can kind of like see it. It seems like an obvious way to kind of grow debate a little bit, and maybe also to keep it from being becoming kind of like a Maoist sect where, you know, where it becomes increasingly arcane and there's fewer and fewer people participating in it. So
policy debate is full blown Maoism, I'd say.
I'm kind of thinking, I'm like, can you have a non-denominational debate program? And in some sense, you know, if you think about it from the religious perspective, you could also do this with parties, like, oh, what's your tendency? You know, all these kind of ridiculous things. But if you think about it through religion or Christianity, people are like, I'm non-denominational. And people are kind of like, okay, you roll your eyes. You're like, you really, you're just something else and you're not saying it. But it's kind of also embarrassing to have a denomination and be like, I'm really into Episcopalianism. It's also kind of embarrassing. It's embarrassing either way, I think, kind of to have it. But I just feel like no one's really taken the non-denominational debate strategy seriously, because I think, as we've talked about on this podcast many times, or as you have, Steve, the kind of format gets collapsed into debate. But I wonder if that's maybe also the format also eclipses the debates themselves. The debates aren't actually important. They're not recorded because it's just kind of what moves happen in the format. It's the product at the end, the statistic gets preserved. So maybe one way to kind of think about what would be alternatives for debates is really about this recording or preserving of the debates themselves, making them objects of interest that you can have some interaction with after the event that would, I don't know, maybe have a different gravitational effect than what we normally get. But I'm not sure. This is just a hypothesis.
No, that's great. That reminds me of several years ago, Shanera Reed Brinkley, who was has been involved in a lot of debate stuff.
Yes,
probably most notably the horrible CETA event with for Hayes and all that.
Some things are archived that maybe shouldn't.
Yeah, the only things that are archived are the shit.
Way to impact. Way to bring up that one.
I am impact turning you, Tim. That's right.
Yeah.
I think that or it's a solvency turn, maybe, I don't know. Anyway, she gave a great interview. And I can't remember who it was to, but it's archived somewhere. I have the link, I can put it in the show notes, but she was making that argument years ago of saying that the proper frame is that the 1AC is the research. So if everyone took on the moniker of researchers, that you're producing something that's at a higher standard of research than a college paper, maybe something that could be a blueprint for a master's degree. Many people did take their 1ACs and wrote a master's thesis on it. It was a standard practice for many years.
Yes.
Like you can go to like Baylor University Library. Baylor University would be a great test case. And like go look at the master's degrees that were published and then look at what cases Baylor was running in the 80s. You're going to find a one-to-one correspondence, I guarantee you.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were other people who did this too, like, famously at Pitt, there was Newman, the famous debate coach there who was there forever. He would write a book about the topic area every year and publish it, like Chinese relations. Like, he's no expert on Chinese relations.
Yeah.
But as a debate coach, he felt like, oh, I have all of this knowledge. I have all of these cards. I've listened to all this debate. I can write something about this now. And this was just like a common thing he would just do.
Yeah.
That's kind of like, I think what Schneer Reed Brinkley's talking about is thinking about this as something beyond, I don't know. I mean, the sports thing I think would definitely work, but it's something that we got to think about this as more, I think what she's saying, maybe she'd disagree with me if she's here, is that we put this more into line with the normal activities of the intellectual academic side of the university. But those are two good paths you could try. I just think about William Holly Davis saying, I don't want to be adjunct to sport. The only person who teaches sport at my, this is like 1917, he's writing this. The only person who teaches sport at my college is a broken down old pugilist who wanders the campus. And if I'm going to be like him, let me know, because I want to resign today.
Yeah. You don't want to be a pugilist.
You don't want to be a broken down old pugilist. Maybe a pugilist is okay. William Holly Davis was he was kind of spicy, so. I think he's fine punching people.
I definitely, sought that, the great potential of debate was less to produce, technocrats and more, warrior academics.
Yeah, right. A lot of them
I feel like it would be good to have a movie, though, that's like Darren Aronofsky's The Wrestler, but it's just called The Debate Coach, and it's just about like an old, broken down, like going back in for one more tournament debate coach. I think that would be a good, very helpful representation of debate in media.
We don't have a lot of good pop culture debate references, do we? Not a lot.
Mm-mm.
It appears from time to time.
There's a Community episode.
Yeah. Community episode, then there's an episode of Boston Public that's pretty good.
You got the Great Debaters?
The Great Debaters. I think that's pretty good, but my elderly mother blurted out in the theater as she slept through a lot of it. This movie isn't really about debate. This is about racism. Thanks, Mom. Good insight. Thank you. Siskel and Ebert and Mrs. Yano. Yeah. Here we go. One of the great memories of my life. I actually enjoyed that movie, but historically, I think they got Melvin Tolson down. Years later, I did a workshop at Howard University, and the room was full of students who wanted to learn about debate, and then a couple of graduate students too. We did a workshop on BP debate, and I was like, Melvin Tolson is somebody we can't forget. Da, da, da. And somebody, older person in the back, was like, yeah, I met Melvin Tolson. He lived to be a long, old guy, 90s he died, I think. Like, he was in his 90s. He lived a long time. And he came in to a some debate meeting. And in true Melvin Tolson fashion, he went around the room and told everyone what argument they were going to make and how they were going to do it. Like, just like Denzel Washington portrays him in the film. So I think they got him right. He's like, no, you can't make that argument. Make this one. Like writing arguments for them and all that. Very funny. Let's see. What other thing? I wanted to talk about this before the show. We're talking about how, or at the beginning of the show, I was talking about how I keep getting dragged back into weird stuff. I got an email from, I want to get this right because it's a very formal title. I'm going to have to search for this again in my email. I feel like I have too many email addresses. The NPDL TOC director emailed me. Joel Jacobs. Does anybody want to judge this weekend, April 6th and 7th in New York City? The National Parliamentary Debate League Tournament of Champions will be held in New York City. We look for experienced debate judges, experienced coaching or judging parliamentary debate. This tournament brings together the best high school parliamentary debaters in the U.S. High school. At first, when I saw NPDL TOC, I was thinking that the NPTE had renamed itself. But this has nothing to do with the NPTE, from what I can tell.
National Parliamentary Debate League, is that what it stands for?
Yeah, I guess it would be National Parliamentary Debate League, I guess. I don't know anything about them. The high school, do you know anything about, you guys know anything about this? High school parley?
No.
No.
I have no familiarity with it particularly. I can't imagine it is horribly different from what's happening at college parley. Just because, I don't know, whenever I was debating in high school, you know, if you wanted to be really competitive and try to get ahead of the curve, you looked at what the college kids were doing, you know?
Yeah, it's really weird. When you look at it on tabroom.com, the NPDL board has published a prep video designed to help debaters understand different regional styles they may encounter at the TOC, and a Zoom prep session on March 24th. That's long past. The topic areas will be 1, Nigeria, 2, U.S. domestic food policy. Wow. That's very funny. And it's point-based entry. Anyway, the thing that struck me was the hired judge application.
There were definitely hired judges for the TOC when I was in high school.
Yeah, I mean, it's like what they're going for is very, I don't know. It's just, it's interesting to me from the perspective of an educator. So, you know, are you a coach, current college debater, former high school debater, former college debater, or other? Describe your parliamentary debate judging experience. Number of years, number of tournaments, type of parliamentary debate. Describe your other judging experience. Describe your experience as a competitor. What schools have you coached? What schools have you attended? What clubs you have been on the staff of? What debate summer camps you've been on the staff of? Any other potential conflicts? What's your paradigm? Link to it on Tab Room. Are you a member of an underrepresented group in debate? And then you got to be there all day or you won't get your $160. But what's odd to me about this is there's no indication or outreach to people who might be, I mean, you're in New York City. I would think you might want to reach out to people who are experts on, there might be some here, just saying, on Nigeria or U.S. domestic food policy. That might be interesting to have high school kids interact with experts. I mean, this is a long-running problem. You know, Paul Hayes and I helped set up the Civic Debate League. But now that's just become another tournament game. There's no value to that. The social justice debates or whatever, it's just another competition. There's not, you know, it's another Maoist modeled kind of thing. But Paul Hayes used to use his pull in DC and bring in people from agriculture department or people from different NGOs. I just think it's high school kids coming to New York. Wouldn't it be cool if they could interact with somebody from the Nigerian embassy, you know? But I think I have different goals than these people.
Yeah, 100%. I wholly agree with that. As an educator, I understand why that list of questions is super concerning. It's also, yeah, I mean, right, like if you are, generally speaking, the TOC, you know, tends to believe that this model is fantastic, right? They're definitely, you know, going to build a judge application that is all about optimizing the competitive experience for competitors, I guess.
Yeah, this goes back to Tim's question about, like, what's your religion? And I think, you know, if people are like, I'm going to the Episcopalian conference and then they encounter nothing but Catholics or, you know, spiritual astrology women, they might get kind of angry.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I think that's right. And it's like if you strongly identify with a particular format or way of doing debate, even if you're aware that there are other ways of doing debate, you know, that's kind of what you have already decided is valuable. So I think that maybe it's like not that useful to try to go into that format and be like, well, let's have a convention where, like, there, like, one strategy would be like, well, let's be ecumenical. Let's get everybody together and see what we all agree on. And I'm like, I actually don't know that that's the right way here. I mean, I think the thing that you were talking about before, Steve, about the missed opportunity of the pandemic, I don't think it's totally missed because, for one thing, pandemic's still kind of going on, like, a little bit, and ravaged budgets, and a lot of, like, you know, big teams are gone. Pitt, Vegas, Emporia, Berkeley,
SIU.
You know, yeah, Arizona. Like,
SIU is walking distance for me.
SIU is like, who ever thought SIU would collapse? But then, you know, Emporia State, my God.
So I think that's, like, the idea that there could be other ways of doing this now has like a motivation to do it differently because of the material constraints of being like, no, we actually can't do this. Like, a lot of places can't do this. So if models appear of a different way of kind of introducing debate institutionally, like debate across the curriculum, or I don't know, different kind of ways of doing online debates, I'm really interested in something that I'm kind of I've worked on a little bit and want to kind of keep working on, called book debates, where you partner with local bookstores and you kind of take a book that's a popular kind of contemporary best-selling book and create a debate about it and have it at the bookstore and try to kind of help people sell the book or talk about the book in that way. I think that having other models maybe is the moment. It still is the moment for that because there are going to be places that simply can't do it. So if we look at what debate actually looks like right now, you're going to find maybe some of these sad stories. But I do actually think that there's quite a bit of possibility here, because that the kind of desire of debate is really important is being said by also by people who don't have that idea of debate. They don't really maybe have any totally clear idea of what debate should be. They just know that it should be happening somewhere. Someone should be doing it. Kind of like science, you know, it's like, we all love science. I fucking love science. I don't know anything about it. I just hope that other people are doing it. Is maybe kind of not a bad attitude that exists around debate, in that if we can present something that's maybe helpful or useful or different, people who are excited about that model can do it. Right now, I think part of the problem of that is, like, the models that exist that are kind of very easily able to be accessed, things like an Urban Debate League model, like you get a packet, you get all of these materials that puts you on the track to produce the model that already exists. And that's the reason why that kind of is successful is not because it's better, because it's easier to access all of those materials. So now is the time to, like, reinstitutionalize or kind of recreate forms that can be, I don't know, this is a very, like, proselytizing idea here, I guess, like being evangelical, non-denominational of just a different way of doing it, which means creating materials for other people to do it, or formats or modes that allow it to appear in other places. So I think if you want to think without the tournament or beyond the tournament, you have to create materials that will allow other people to do it, and that would be the test of whether it works or not.
Yeah, it sounds like a really good project, actually. It reminds me of I think once in a while people will try to do this, but it's like established debate programs will do it. And they'll point to that to their administration and, like, see, we're engaging the community. But, like, all of these debaters want to take a shower immediately after talking to the community or debating with the community. They're like, they can't get in the shower fast enough. Arguments are so bad. Where's the dial, you know? And it's like, oh, give me the detox shampoo. But I think that there part of it also, I think, is this long legacy of, like, what does a good debate look like? This Cartesian kind of model versus, I don't know what to call it, the more rhetorical model, the more the context determines the good debate, rather than, well, we have to perfect these tools before they can be made public. And then when you put them in the hands of the public, they're going to hurt themselves. Like, I think a lot of times they think of, like, the TOC. Like, debate theory is like a circular saw, and it's like, I can't just hand a circular saw to a kid. Like, it's going to cause a lot of damage. So there's that.
They just won't know how to turn it on.
Yeah. It's like, what do I do with it? Like, what would I do with this? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you make arguments. What do you mean? How would I use this to make an argument? It just cuts things apart. Like, they don't even have the sense of where it functions in the invention, the rhetorical invention process. So, I think that it's an endless project to perfect the tools of argument and debate to an Enlightenment standard. And that's why the college policy is still doing what it's doing, and NPDA and the tournament of parliamentary excellence and NP and all these things, they're all like, we're getting there. We just need more theory.
Yeah.
It's this endless it's this endless chase of towards purity, which they'll never get to. And actually, what would improve their argument, theory, and stuff would be to bring in, like, I get laughed out of the room. People, you know, when I was in the BP circuit, people really would engage me and be like, okay, well, what kind of tournament do you want? And my reaction was like, let's get a big grant and we'll use it to pay the workers at your college, people who just work there, or pay for them to have childcare or whatever they need to come in and be the judges, the food service, mm-hmm. the physical plant, the custodians, whoever you call staff, they should judge the tournament. And they'd be like, oh my God. And then that would be the end of the conversation.
Yeah, I mean, when I did the thing in Pittsburgh where I took students onto the public transit and had them debate, so they would like hand out these little menus with like three debate topics that they decided based on reading the local paper that these would be like things that would be relevant. And it was pretty wild and chaotic to be fair. Cause so they would just like hand it out. And if someone was like, yeah, I'll hear what you have to say about it. And two students would give just like a very brief 1 minute speech on each one. But some people had like this. And then the people sitting on the people mover would judge which was the better argument. And the students learned way more from that than they learned from doing their own research, because they got perspectives that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise. I remember this one guy who they thought was like, they're like, oh, he's, they just thought he was like a vagrant, I think. And he was like, there was a debate about nuclear power in Pittsburgh or something. And he's like, I actually used to be an engineer. And he just like sat down. I think he like stayed a little bit longer past the stop to tell them all the things about how nuclear radiation actually works, why their arguments were wrong. I was like, this is great.
That
I mean, that's
great.
That's not a scalable model either, but I think that, yeah, just like there's just a lot of creative fun things we could do with debate as a techne, and we can create technologies around it. So maybe we need to be like Lewis Mumford, who has that great weird word technics, which for me kind of is that combination yeah. of the technology and the practices that surround it. And if we thought about debate that way, be like, sure, debate does have a lot of technologies that it's created. It's created a whole series of technologies in different formats, but we have to also think about, you know, those are always associated with different practices. What do we want these technologies to do? We can always create new ones. It's based on the practice that we are actually trying to foster, and we can have a debate about that, what we want.
Yeah, like technology. Like we were talking in Boston about my student who learned flowing. It was using flowing in her law internship or whatever.
Yeah.
Super, that's in a great court. Application. Yeah, in court, flowing the arguments yeah. in court and being like, oh, here's what they missed. Here's where we can get them.
I think something that's sort of interesting about that idea is that, I don't know, I definitely feel like every time we, or maybe not every time, but so far with American competitive debate, every time they, you know, create one of these, like, you know, stripped down like lay friendly air quotes formats, like it all starts down the timeline of just becoming it just does all the policy debate stuff over time, right? Like,
yeah,
because I mean, like, you know, people, if they're if the debate is evidence heavy, like standards of evidence start to come up, right? And you know, the theory develops, like people get faster, like it just happens eventually. I don't know, I definitely felt like debating IPDA this year, like it's sort of in that growing pain where it's just sort of like, well, you know, we're not supposed to be, you know, it's supposed to be very lay friendly and you're not supposed to use like any jargon, but like also they want you to you know, state, you know, like air quotes, like the weighing mechanism at the beginning of the round. And I'm just like, this is all very
right.
I'm just sort of like, this is just LD 1.0. Like,
I think that's a really important aspect of this. And I know, Steve, you know so much of the debate history that you could speak to this in a different way. But I think it's like, it reminds me of a couple things that actually are related to public speaking, which is what I teach a lot. So people will kind of teach public speaking. I just kind of heard a student speak in a different class. And she is at the beginning, she's talking about like what history needs to remember. And she's kind of giving her arrangement for her speech. And she's like, first I'm going to do this, first I'm going to do that. But then she talked about like totally random different things. Like she talked about Gandhi and the U.S. Civil War. And she talked about Chernobyl. And I'm like, to me, it feels really unarranged. But that kind of marker of arrangement that gets taught and passed down through public speaking classes starts to appear natural to people. Like, well, there needs to be some arrangement. And the thing that's really easy to teach about arrangement, which is if you just kind of say at the beginning whatever you're going to talk about, that arranges the speech, is I think what produces that. I don't think that's the natural way it has to go. And so I wonder whether one of the ways to interpret why this keeps happening is it's not the natural kind of tendency of argument, which is maybe how people tend to do it. Like, okay, arguments just end up with seven off case arguments. Inevitably, that's just where it goes. It's like, well, maybe that's being produced. It's a kind of pseudomorphosis to the format in which we kind of teach or train people for debate, which is here always the competitive intercollegiate tournament. And I think that produces a pressure that does lead to that naturally. But that's not the only kind of way to think about speech or debate. So if you listen to a public speaking speech from a class, they are so horrible. They're so boring. I would never want anyone to speak like that in their job or anywhere. So why do we keep teaching people to speak this way? Why do we teach a 5-paragraph essay?
Yeah.
And I'm like, if you ever read a 5-paragraph essay, you'd throw it in the trash. If you saw that in a magazine, you throw it in the trash. I think we teach those things because they're easy to teach.
Yeah.
Because the demand for somebody to be like, how do I do this? Be like, here's how you do it. And the ability to immediately meet the demand of someone who's trying to learn actually creates a miseducation. And so I think that like for in all of these things, whether it's writing or speaking or debating, these kind of things that are very difficult to teach that really ask us as subjects that speak and communicate in language, how we can cover over this gap of how we communicate ideas to other people, how we formulate arguments and make things make sense. When people encounter that for the first time, it produces anxiety. And they're like, I don't know how to do this. I don't know how to organize this. And so feeling like the teacher that can come in and assuage that feeling and be like, oh, let me show you how to do it. You just follow this simple technique. Also leads to this cynical attitude where I can always give people the answer and then I can look at their writing and be like, look at what students write. It's so crap. Look at how students speak.
Yeah.
It's so boring. So it actually reaffirms my position as a teacher. I think this is the cycle that we're in with debate. And I think it relates to the idea that we don't really take what students do in debate very seriously. And we create the conditions by which it's not really worth taking seriously. Because if people are always going to argue in these same ways, it's kind of like, yeah, I don't know. I've heard it all before. And it's not very compelling.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. Yeah, creating a spot where you're needed. I mean, you know, the deprofessionalization of debate, like speaking historically, deprofessionalization of debate is a huge issue here. We used to have tenure track faculty, research faculty running the debate program. And now it's all people with master's degrees, if that. And there's no, you know, burden for research. They're contract employees, so they have to produce results. So one of the things of like justifying, only I can teach this, I think that falls into it too, is it's just an economic concern.
Yeah.
I think it would be much, much better to have tenure track debate director positions who then hire people under them to operate the program, which could have a competitive component. And then another component that tries to do something for the university, the community. I don't know why this is not the model. I think as debate got weirder and weirder like that, faculty just kind of wanted to disassociate themselves from it. So they're like, ah, the debate coach is retiring. Thank God. You know, we'll just hire an adjunct to run it, and we'll just not, you know, plausible deniability is a great friend of ours. We'll just, you know, they can run it, and if things go haywire, we'll fire them. And it's just kind of where it is today, sadly. But that's part of it too. But yeah, the creation, I don't know why these things get replicated, because the creation of CETA in 1971 was the Southwestern Cross-Examination Debate Association. This guy named Jack Howe, who was a Long Beach professor, was probably most directly responsible for it, or he was sort of the PR guy for it. And he argued he wasn't trying to replace NDT or challenge NDT, but he was really kind of used arguments you'd have for a seed vault. Like, we need an organization that will practice the kinds of debate that NDT does not lean itself towards. So NDT is seen as this highly technical, very evidence-heavy, internal evidence analysis at that time was so crazy. Like, people are winning on arguments based on the arguments based on the internals of cards. Mm-hmm. And so it was very technical and required a lot of research and a lot of reading and a lot of stuff that we just don't do today in evidence production and policy debate. And that wasn't attractive to a lot of students. So they were like, well, let's do this maybe other version where we do value-oriented topics or topics that are more audience-centric instead of specialist-centric. And it was really kind of a seed vault argument, which I thought was fascinating because I think the story that gets told is the seed of people were like, we're tired of being oppressed by NDT. We're going to revolt and create our own organization, and we're going to show you what real debate is like. But this isn't shorn up by the archive at all. As time goes on, they start to defend themselves more vociferously. But that's just because they're starting to do the old practices again. As they get closer, they have to be more violent about the differences. But yeah, I think you're right about the cycle. It's hard to think about how to break that if that's a higher ed thing as well. Pretty tough. Well, I think that we finished the first episode here. We're coming up on just about the right time to kind of wrap it up. That's good.
It was nice to be back in the bin with you. Thanks for having.
Yeah, anytime at all, anytime you want. Any final thoughts as we say goodbye?
One of the questions you asked me earlier was about what's changed over the years. And I do think that, I mean, not that it was ever the absolute highest, but just from, I mean, NFL to NFALD at this point is essentially one person policy.
Yeah.
And the overall standards for just people just don't do research anymore. And if you like people, if you run an argument people aren't prepped for, they're just gonna theory dump you. There was very, very little incentive to ever the level of engagement is through the floor.
Yeah, you can think about debate the way I used to think about it was like model building, like build this this Spitfire British warplane from World War II. Here's the model kit, and you have to like use a knife and kind of clean up the pieces and some glue and paint and everything. And now it's kind of like buy the model and put the stickers on it.
Yeah.
That's kind of what it feels like, sadly. And oh, this made me think of another thing when Tim was talking about the cycle of like, there might be something natural to the way this argument goes, but it's, you know, seven off might be natural at some point. It made me think about when I was a kid, I really couldn't believe that plants were like alive and growing. And then I saw a time lapse of like a tree growing. And I was like, oh my God. Mm. And so maybe like debate is like a time lapse of the way, this could be a defense of the tournament, right? You could make that you say, okay, it's a time lapse of the way arguments occur in the public, but we have to do it in like 2 hours. So it's a time, like, let's set the shutter to every 5 seconds, take a picture. So over time, with enough participants and enough interest in the public argument, all of these lines of argument would eventually come out. So it's a nice simulation of a long-term, you know, couple of year-long public policy argument, or maybe longer, depending on the topic. That's a way to think about it.
If you're okay with existing in the singularity as a result.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, I think that's not a bad way of thinking about it. I like to talk about mapping the doxa, mapping out all of the like potentially available positions on a public issue. And I think you can think about long-term debates on a single topic that way. But I think the other thing you would have to admit then is what do we see in that time lapse is also the death of the argument, the death of it ceases to be public every time. It goes to the point where the argumentation is no longer about itself. And so that compression of time that happens in you know, the dossier even of the, you know, the hardcore policy team that's not just running their critical af and neg is going to be something that will show that there's a way that this argument can't continue in the public. Yeah. I wonder whether that might also be an argument for the tournament, but maybe that's the argument for the tournament that I wouldn't want to make. I'm like, I kind of don't want to see the whole thing. I think I kind of want it to have that moment where you go into the botanical garden and you look around at the variety of arguments that there are, and you leave with a sense that there's kind of more than you realize.
Yeah.
When you're an audience member and you kind of go home and you're like, maybe I should plant something.
Yeah. The garden of rhetorical delights or whatever from that.
Yeah.
That book. What is that book? The Jeffrey, shoot, I have no memory for the bibliography anymore. I need to write all these things down before I get on the air. It's so sad. The Ancient Teachers of This Art, Jeffrey
Walker.
Walker, yeah. He talks about how the old rhetoric teachers talk about the garden of rhetoric and all the, in the classroom, all the arguments are flowering, you know, the students are all coming there. Yeah, they're giving all their arguments. I think that's really good. And also your suggestion of what a cool tournament that would be if the debate format were like, you win the debate if you have been convincing that you have mapped out all of the available doxa of the moment of the argument, all the different ways it could go. And then the other side could say, no, that's not really going to go that way. It's better to think of it this way. And then you like give the win to the team who's better mapped out the resources for the public argument. That would be a cool competition.
That's the hydrangea in the garden. It's like a hydra. It has all of the heads. You're like, look at all of these different blossoms.
Right, a debate in a format that rewards acknowledging the maximal perspective of viewpoints as opposed to collapsing.
Yeah, right. They're like, this whole debate, all these hours and arguments that you've heard, all come down to the fact that it is theoretically illegitimate to advocate a perm. We win. It's like all these pages and pages and pages of interesting evidence. No, I'm not going to call for any of that because, yeah, you didn't answer the number three off the five of perm advocacy theory. So got to give it to them. Got to give it to them, boys. Try again next time.
Sorry, guys. You cheated.
Yeah, you're theoretically illegitimate. So all of your research is for naught. No wonder people don't research.
Yeah. Seriously.
You can just win on picks are illegitimate and just win the whole debate. I did a lot of coaching like that in my time. I can't. I'm as dirty as it comes.
Ooh.
Yeah, I'm not perfect.
I'm like, here you go, novices. If they run a counterplan, ask them what the status of the counterplan is. And they'll say, I don't know. Yeah. And then you say, is it dispositional? And they'll say, I guess. And then read these 20 things on the piece of paper that say dispositionality is illegitimate and we'll win the debate.
That's how you became a two-diamond coach.
Oh,
double
baby.
Diamond, Steve.
Yeah.
Double diamond, Yano.
Yeah. There you go. I'm not a diamond. I don't even think I was. I didn't even become a diamond anything. I'm still
still a brick of coal.
I'm still like dinosaur DNA under an intense amount of pressure. I might become oil. That's possible too.
Ferns in our botanical garden.
The ferns of the ancient world that are being compressed by the earth's molten crust into diamonds.
Yes.
Rihanna, shine bright like a diamond. That'll end this episode.
I think I was just a generic dirty rock coach.
There you go. All right, next time, geography, geology, and debate. Next time. Thanks, Tim.
Sounds good. Yeah, my pleasure.
Thank you, Mishka. Thank you. And In the Bin, you can find it on Spotify. We're all over the place, so find it there. And then, if you have a show idea or you want us to talk about something, inthebinpodcast@gmail.com, just email us, and we'll get on to it. All right? Talk to you on the next episode.
Interesting.